creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
Today on a very special part two of Culture Click, we continue our coverage of race manners. We visit with Bruce A. Jacobs, author of Race Manners for the 21st Century, Getting Real About Race in Everyday Life. Bruce is the rare social change advocate who both lays out the big issues of racial politics and equips us to handle them in everyday life. With his dynamic presence, his empathy with audiences, and the plain-spoken clarity of his book, Race Manners, Bruce is able to encourage people of goodwill to change bigotry and to work for our common benefit. Today, in part two of our interview with Bruce, we ask if there are certain areas of the U.S. that have a better grasp on race manners than others, the topic of building a mosque in NYC near the World Trade Center, and what Americans can learn from the mosque situation. Following that, we'll hear part two of his lecture, Five Things They Never Taught You About Race, which was presented this September at Winona State University. In part one of the lecture, Bruce covered these three points. It's okay to screw up as long as you do not give up, that nobody is lying, and that we have been set up not to see one another. We continue with our interview with Bruce and learn the last two things that they never taught you about race. You're listening to Culture Click on KQAL. Are there certain areas in the U.S. that have a better grasp of race relations than others, and what is it that they would be doing to further themselves?
Well, you know, I don't know if I can answer that. It's a really good question. I wish that I had traveled enough to be able to give you a really... I mean, I've been across the country more times than I can tell you. I've spoken in many, many places. I travel for pleasure a lot. So I've met a lot of people in a lot of places, from the Pacific Northwest to Arizona to the Far West to the Deep South to New York to the Midwest to, you know, the Mid-Atlantic where I live. But I guess the closest to an answer that I could give you is that the communities that I've seen where diversity and awareness of diversity seems to thrive the most are those that are the most diverse to begin with. Mm-hmm. They kind of have the raw material for diversity, which is a critical mass of people who are mixing that creates a kind of, you know, unpredictability, or maybe variety is a better word, to who you're likely to encounter in any given place on any given day. Now, having said that, in places that are technically very diverse, like Baltimore, which has been more non-white than white for many, 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 many years, there can also be really, really strict and nasty segregation. Mm. And there is. So the sheer reality of there being a large number of people of color as opposed to a large number of whites in one geographic location doesn't necessarily mean everybody's kind of mingling and getting along. Some of that's class. Some of that has to do with economics. Some of it just has to do with the tradition of race. It seems that having an institution of learning, having institutions of higher learning, colleges and universities, in the community helps a lot, because they bring in people from outside the community who bring all of their experiences, right, their expertise, their global perspective. Plus, there tend to be more things to do associated with a college and a university. So that certainly helps. So I think if you've got a community that has a variety of people in it to begin with, and if there's some influence in the community, be it a school, be it some sort of big institution like a big hospital, right, or a big company that brings in people from a lot of different places, whatever it is, I think that helps that community to function as a more vibrantly, a community where people are more vibrantly aware of one another's presence and they're happy about it.
What is your take on the building of a mosque in NYC near the World Trade Site?
Well, you know, we could talk for, an hour and a half. Your show's going to have to be a lot longer now, Terry. The gist of it is that I think it shouldn't be an issue. I think that we shouldn't even be talking. And I think it's unfortunate that we mm-hmm. even need to talk about whether members of a worldwide religion have the right or should be allowed or should be criticized for building a center a cultural center that includes a mosque a couple of blocks from the World Trade Center. Let me put it this way. If we were to hold the entirety of Catholicism, mm-hmm. let's say, responsible for all of the atrocities, just the recent ones, not even the ones going back to the Crusades, but
right.
like the recent ones committed in its name by so-called Catholics, we wouldn't be allowed to build a single new Catholic cathedral in the United States. And yet we apply this standard to Islam as if we are qualified to judge an entire religion because a small group of people who called themselves Muslims,
right.
who draped themselves in the cloak of Islam, right,
mm-hmm.
did a terrible thing that killed thousands of people. I think the opposition to the mosque is a reflection of, unfortunately, how willing many Americans still are to believe and carry out double standards, ethnic double standards, basically. At this point, kind of cloaked in religion, but it's really about ethnicity. It's really saying, well, we won't allow anybody else to generalize about our religion or us as people because people who look and act like us have done terrible things. But it's okay for us to generalize about your religion and people who look like you because a few people who worship your faith did terrible things. It's not fair. And I think it's a shame that we're even having the discussion. I wrote an open letter on my blog, which I'll plug. It's aliasbruce.typepad.com, where I wrote an open letter to the two developers of that mosque, Islamic Center in New York, asking them, really begging them, to not move it, because I don't think they should. I think this country needs the benefit of a painful lesson for a lot of people in what it means to be fair in a democracy. So that's basically what I think about that.
So what America can learn from this, and this was like my last part of the question, is what as a nation can we learn from this? And basically it's really understanding each other and mm-hmm. the facts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what America can learn from this is that if we're going to call ourselves a democracy, the same rules that we apply to ourselves need to apply to other people who live here.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bottom line. Some Americans are not there yet. They think that they want a democracy, but they really don't. They really want something that looks more like a kind of tyranny by people who look and act like them. That's not democracy. And I think what we can learn from this is that America will look a little bit more like democracy when there is an Islamic center honoring one of the world's great religions, two blocks from a place where a few people who called themselves members, devotees of that religion, did a terrible thing. Because if we're not willing to do that, then, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to have to declare a moratorium on the building of all churches
everywhere.
And synagogues.
Yeah.
You know, any major religion is not going to be able to build any more new buildings. It would be highly impractical. I think we should build the Islamic Center and the mosque. And I think it's a good thing. And I think it will happen.
Thanks for taking time out to talk with us.
Terry, it's been my pleasure. Thanks.
And you're listening to Culture Click on 89.5 FM KQAL Winona.
We now go to part two of Bruce's lecture, The Five Things They Never Taught You About Race.
Okay. Item number four of what we never get taught about race, and we should, is we need to call one another on the things that we do, not on who we think other people are. I'll explain what I mean. Let's say I make a really ugly, derogatory remark about Asian Americans to a group of people who I'm with. And I think it's cool, and I think it's funny, and I think it's okay, right? Let's say I do that. And someone in that group needs to say something to me to let me know that that's not okay, all right? Now, if they were to call me on my action, on my behavior, they would say, Bruce, man, that is not cool.
That is such an uncool thing for you to say. I mean, I don't know why you think it's okay to say that, but, you know, I don't want to hear about that because that's not the way I want to live. It's not the way I want to view other people. And I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that. Like, where are you coming from with this stuff? Right? That's calling me on my behavior. The other way to do it, the far less productive way to do it, is to identify who I am as a human being and then criticize that based on what I did. Which is to say, man, all this time I've known you and I never ever knew that you were such a filthy, venal, disgusting racist. See, it's one thing to call a person on racist behavior. You did something that's racist. You believe something that's sexist. You've acted out something that's homophobic, right? You seem to believe something that I think is religiously bigoted. It's one thing to call a person out on their behavior that way. It's another thing entirely to use a noun to categorize someone based on that behavior, as in, you racist. Okay? You racist. Leave someone no place to go, except to maybe curse you out right back, except to feel put upon, to feel humiliated, and to somehow dredge up some kind of justification within themselves for what they did. Because they know that they don't harbor the kind of deliberate malevolence toward that group of people that you think they do. So therefore, you don't understand them. So therefore, you're full of it. So therefore, everything you've criticized them about is misplaced, right? There they go. They're right off the hook. But if instead your response or their response to me when I make that really awful anti-Asian American remark, if their response to me, instead of saying, Bruce, you racist, is to say, Bruce, you're too smart a guy to be talking like that. Bruce, I love you, man, but I can't be hanging with you saying stuff like that, because that's wrong. Then where's my escape? Because my humanity is being respected and affirmed, right? I'm not being violated in any way, and yet I'm being called out for something I did that's wrong. So I've got room, right, to correct or change or rethink my behavior. And the person has made their point. So you actually have more power if you focus your criticism on a person's behavior while honoring their humanity than you do if you just categorize their humanity willy-nilly. You give them less wiggle room and you give them less room to escape if you focus on their behavior. So that's why I say one of the other things we need to know that we're not told is to call one another on what we do and to not make assumptions about who we are, quote unquote, based on those things. I'm not necessarily a deep, venal, you know, conscious racist. I might just be a really insensitive person who's ignorant about particular kinds of issues. I might be thoughtless, you know? I might be high. I could be in any number of places. And you've got to call me on that. Because I can't get away with that. You shouldn't let me get away with that. I'll tell you a story. I mean, you can tell that part of where I'm going here is that racial prejudice is an equal opportunity illness. Now, I get into conversations about this sometimes. I did a radio show, I've done actually more than one, on black radio stations with black hosts, where the hosts will say things to the effect that, well, wouldn't you agree that black people really can't be racist in a formal sense because racism is an institutional manifestation? It's a set of institutions that carry out patterns of actions toward an identified group of people. And that's something from which whites don't suffer in a racial way. So wouldn't you agree that blacks can't be racist in that sense? And my answer is, well, if you want to talk structurally, yes. Institutional racism is basically a mechanism of white supremacy. That's true. And its relation to whites is different than its relation to blacks, or to Hispanics, or to Asians, or to Native Americans, or to people from any other background. But anybody of any color, of any ethnicity, of any racial, of any sexual orientation, of any religion, of any background, can be prejudiced. Anybody can be racially prejudiced, religiously prejudiced, prejudiced by gender orientation. Man, I go around and I hear some black preachers in black churches preaching the most demonically homophobic stuff from the pulpit about our gay brothers and sisters. And I want to walk up on the pulpit, you know, you can't do this stuff in church, but I want to do stuff you can't do in church. You know, walk up, grab somebody by the lapel and say, you know, brother, after we fought all these decades to be recognized as human beings, after people died in the streets in Mississippi, you're going to get up in the pulpit and kick somebody else who's lower on the ladder than you because you can? I don't think so. So racial prejudice, or prejudice of any type, is an equal opportunity affliction, is what I'm trying to say. I'll give you an example. I'm not going to name any names, because I know better. But one of my relatives, when we were in a restaurant, a bunch of us were in a restaurant eating. I guess that's what they do in restaurants, isn't it? And there was a table of people who appeared to be of Arab descent, actually a booth, like two booths away on the other side. One of my relatives, who happens to be a very loud person, at usually the wrong time, you know what I mean? You have any relatives like that? Took the opportunity to say some really, really horrible things about Americans of Arab descent. This was shortly after 9/11. I left that part out. Okay? And all of us wanted to basically put our faces into our soup, right? Sitting at the table. So we finished our meal, cringing, and we left the restaurant, and I came back in the restaurant. We all felt so bad that I came back into the restaurant and I walked up to the booth of people, the family that was eating, and I said to them, excuse me, I am so sorry to interrupt your meal, but I really, really must apologize to you if you overheard my relative saying the things that she said. I absolutely apologize for that. It was horrible. It was completely unjustifiable. And I want you to know it does not reflect in any way the way that our family feels. And I apologize to you. And they were very gracious about it, and they nodded, and they thanked me, and I left and left them alone. Equal opportunity affliction, I promise you. So this process of calling one another on stuff crosses all racial, gender, nationality, religion lines. And we're going to be doing it for the rest of our lives. Last thing that I think we need to know, even though nobody explicitly tells us this, number five, is it's not about guilt. It's about getting busy. Here's what I mean by this. I've had conversations with people about when you're in a privileged position. I was raised middle class, right? We weren't rich by any means, but I was comfortable. I was raised being economically comfortable. So among populations of a lot of black folks, I was a privileged kid, and I still am, right? Many white Americans enjoy certain invisible privileges that we call white privileges by virtue of their apparent skin color. Any of us who are straight enjoy privileges of not being subject to certain kinds of abuses that our gay brothers and sisters are subject to. And the same thing applies to religions, and the same thing applies to any other number of things about who we are or where we come from. And being in that position of privilege could stymie you if if all you could feel about it, if all you knew to feel about it, was guilty. You know? I've talked sometimes with Caucasian brothers and sisters about white privilege, and I've heard them say, you know, one of the young people in the class that I spoke with today raised the issue. And one of her questions was, you know, what do you do with this thing called white privilege? You know? And the fact is, she didn't ask for it. She didn't create it, right? She didn't make it the way it is. In fact, if she'd had the choice to, like, fill out a questionnaire when she was born, she probably would have checked no on the box and said, do you want to be given a bunch of invisible favors that will make other people resent you for the rest of your life? No, I'll say no on that one. But it was dumped into her lap. Just like I inherit the privileges that I have, I didn't do anything to deserve them. They were just dumped on me. I inherited them, right? White privilege is inherited the same way. So my thing is, it is not about feeling guilty about having inherited white privilege or straight privilege or Christian privilege or whatever privilege you might happen to enjoy because members of other groups are discriminated against in ways that you are not. It's not about feeling guilty or feeling that somebody else wants you to feel guilty when they point out the ways that you are privileged. I am not interested in blaming anyone, for example, for the fact that they inherited white privilege. I have no interest in that whatsoever. How can I blame you for something you didn't do? Right? My thing is, okay, once you understand that you've inherited this thing, that this society plunked in your lap, plumped my kind of privilege in my lap, plumped your kind of privilege in your lap, right? Once we understand that we've inherited this thing in which we are treated differently in subtle or not so subtle ways than other people, in ways that are largely invisible to us, our responsibility is not to feel guilty, for God's sake. Our responsibility is to become aware of it and to do everything we can to honestly prevent its proliferation and to try to put a stop to it. So my thing is, brother, sister, you know, if you feel guilty about white privilege, about straight privilege, about whatever privilege position you're in, I mean, I feel that. I don't want you to feel that way. What I want from you is to be down to do the work to correct what's wrong. Right? If you're privileged because you're white, if you're privileged because you're straight, if you're privileged because you're a Christian or a Jew, right? All I care about is, are you down to do the work from today forward to correct what put you in a position of privilege? And then we're on the same page, brother. We are on the same page, sister. We got the same gospel. We're reading from the same book. So it's not about guilt. Guilt stymies you. Guilt leaves you feeling culpable and bad about yourself and vulnerable. And it also leaves you feeling resentful because you feel as if you're being made to feel guilty for something you didn't cause. And that's not fair. And you know it's not fair. So let's move beyond the guilt to some action. Let's move toward making this society what we think it needs to be. Let's move past the barriers that are thrown up in our way. Because they are barriers, and they are thrown up in our way, and almost all of them are man-made. They're not natural, they're not sort of humanly inherent. They're created by human beings for particular purposes, and just as we created them, we can uncreate them. So I'll close with this. I did another radio show years ago where the host asked me this question, and others have asked me this question too. I think it's a very good question. He essentially said, as others have said, in fact, one of the students in today's class said that, isn't it human nature in a certain way for us to be as abusive toward one another as we are? For life to be as unfair as it is, and for our institutions to be as discriminatory as they are. And my answer to him was, no, it's not human nature. I said, I think human nature is what underlies those layers of institutionally superimposed things that cause the problems. Human nature is who we would otherwise be if we didn't have Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter shrieking at us, if we didn't have media worldwide pumping the airwaves and the internet full of sensational, anxiety-provoking, mostly trivia, okay? It is who we would otherwise be if we did not have a society in which access to electoral office is based on how much money you can raise, if we didn't have a system of organized electoral bribery. Human nature is who we would otherwise be in a society that actually responded to the needs of the public interest instead of to the corruption by the private interest. And I think we need to remember that as we talk about sort of what we're capable of doing and if there's hope or not. Believe me, there are plenty of days when I get up with my head between my knees. I get depressed. Anybody who thinks deeply and works seriously on issues like this has to have sad days, mad days, frustrated days. One of my sisters has a bumper sticker that says, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. Everybody has days like that, right? But my thing is, it doesn't take a majority to cure the ills of a society. What was created by humans can be undone by humans. And even if we can't make anything like a utopia, we can certainly make our society better than it is, because we've done it before. Slavery in the United States was ended by a minority of people. There was never a majority of Americans marching on Washington saying, end slavery now, end slavery now. It didn't happen. Most Americans stood around watching while slavery was legal for the hundreds of years that it was legal. What ended slavery was a dedicated, unstoppable minority of abolitionists who would not quit until their cause was won, because it was just. When women tried to get the vote at the turn of the century, more than 100 years ago, there was never a majority of Americans marching on Washington, give women the vote, give women the vote. It's not the way it happened. There was a dedicated majority, dedicated minority, dedicated significant minority of suffragettes who wanted voting rights for women, who would not quit until voting rights were gained. When we had Jim Crow in the American South and segregation was legal and lynching was legal, and people of color were barred from public universities. You're too young to remember this, but there was a time when a governor named George Wallace stood in front of the doors of a public university in his state and declared that never on his watch would a black person walk through those doors. Okay? There was never a huge majority of Americans saying equal voting rights, equal civil rights for African Americans, for Negroes, as they were called at the time, for black people. There was never a majority. There was a significant, unstoppable minority that would not quit until the civil rights movement achieved historic goals. So my point here is that even if we can't achieve some sort of Skinnerian utopia, we can get a mite sight farther than we've gotten so far. We can move a lot farther forward than we have so far, and it doesn't take a majority of Americans to do it. Right now, as we speak, we are in the middle of what I consider to be, in a lot of ways, the big civil rights issue of our time in this country, which is equal rights for gay Americans. And that is another significant minority of Americans that will not quit until equality under the law is accomplished. There are a lot of people who are really, really scared of that, who really hate that idea, and I think one of the reasons they hate the idea is they can see the train coming, and it's an unstoppable train. So what I would ask of you in closing is that you do what you can to be a part of that significant minority. You do what you can to, in any given day, pick your spots, You have a right to pick where you put your energy, where you expend your energy, what issues are nearest and dear to you. You can't be all things to all people. But dedicate a meaningful part of yourself to the things that I've been talking about. Be a part of this significant minority that makes our country better. Because farther down the line, those who argued against you, their descendants will nod their heads in gratitude toward you. I'm an old guy. I've been doing this a long time. So I'm looking to you, and I'm asking you, and I'm counting on you to move forward and help make the difference. Blessings to all of you. Thank you for your attention.
A big thank you to Bruce A. Jacobs for taking a moment to talk to us about race manners and for letting us record his lecture that he gave at Winona State University this September. Another big thank you goes to Alexander Hines at Winona State University, who works in inclusion and diversity as the Cultural Diversity Director, for organizing the lecture.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.